Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
This is The Guardian.
I mean, I know and have for many years moved among people, particularly from an Islamic, an Arabic background, Palestinians who I've known, who feel like their voice isn't heard. And it is important to address that. And, you know, obviously our government's moved quite a bit and sort of been involved in voting in December, for example, in ceasefire. But I think there'd be a lot of people that understand there are different views, and there'd be people that think, well, we could have moved quicker, and I understand why they might have those views.
Hi, I'm Daniel Hurst from Guardian Australia's politics team, coming to you from the lands of the Ngunnawal and Ngambri peoples. This week on the podcast, we're joined by Ed Husic. I spoke with the Minister for Industry and Science on Monday. Now, he's at the forefront of the government's new push to support domestic manufacturing and deliver what it calls a future made in Australia. But how exactly is this going to work? And how can the government avoid it becoming a money pit? Now, outside of his portfolio, Husic has spoken up about the war in Gaza. He's accused the Israeli government of failing to observe international law. I wanted to know why he's made his voice heard on this issue and whether he's faced any repercussions within his government for speaking up. Minister Ed Husic, thanks very much for joining us here in the Podcave.
Thanks, Dan.
So this future made in Australia, which is emerging as a budget centrepiece and, dare I say it, a re-election pitch as well, why is the government going down this path and what assurances can you give people that it's not just going to be a money pit?
From our perspective, it's been something we actually took in the 2022 election, and it was informed by events we all lived through. We had a global pandemic that impacted on us, particularly in terms of the way that our supply chains didn't work. It brought to light the fact that so much of the products that we use are effectively made out of one country, and so you've got to diversify the way in which your products are made. And we also have other big challenges, not the least of which being climate change and how do we make the transition. So the idea of having a national reconstruction fund with seven priority areas that look to scale up manufacturing capability, make sure we have the products we need at the time we need them most, that we're not dependent on broken and concentrated supply chains. That's been a starting point that we are now building on further and further with the Future Made in Australia initiatives, and particularly what the PM spoke to last week. It is important for us to seize opportunities that are here. Too many of our ideas and our great work leave our shores only to be manufactured by someone else, and then we import them back at much higher prices.
What are the sorts of products you're thinking of?
Well, not the least of which, I mean, we've just released today, for example, the Medical Sciences Co-Investment Plan that highlights the challenges and opportunities in that priority area of the National Reconstruction Fund that says, for example, we're in the top 10 globally for the quality of our medical research, and yet we're at the bottom of the OECD for translating that into manufacturing product, medicines, medical devices and technologies. And we're just missing this huge opportunity, particularly coming out of a pandemic where we say we want to be able to move quickly to protect people and to be able to also deal with the other conditions and issues that confront people from a health perspective, and having Australian-made solutions to those that are tethered to the thinking, the research done by Australian medical researchers and scientists, I mean, is an obvious starting point.
And I should just point out for the benefit of listeners that we're recording this on Monday and it'll be released on Saturday. So just on the sort of big picture, the Prime Minister has also flagged that there'll be a Future Made in Australia Act. What sorts of things broadly would be in that? Would it be subsidies, co-investment, underwriting? What is it beyond the slogan?
Well, it would be a bit of a career-limiting choice for me to reveal all the details.
Go on.
yes, I'm sure that you would be very keen to cheer me on to do that. I think what we're flagging is that we are looking at a range of different mechanisms that will help grow. As I've said previously in some of the research we released through the Industry Innovation Science Australia body that talked about industry structure, the fact that we've got a lot of small businesses, some large, and we've got this whole missing middle, and they drive demand on R&D, they drive demand on commercialising things, making products. We've got a range of different mechanisms that we think we can put into play to help deal with those things that innately people, Australians get. We need to be a country that makes things. The economic evidence shows that if you've got a strong manufacturing base, it's important for your economy. And the other big thing is that nearly 90% of the jobs in Australian manufacturing are full-time secure jobs as well. And people want to know what's the nature of work long-term in a society that's changing, particularly as a result of technology.
I think people are generally supportive of the idea of making more things in Australia. It's just how do you make sure it's not about picking winners and wasteful spending?
Well, countries are picking winners. I mean, I almost feel like we've got this sort of outpost mentality. The world has moved around us and we're still clutching onto the orthodoxies of the past. Most countries have recognised they need to invest in capability. I mean, you've seen one of the most ambitious examples of that with the Inflation Reduction Act in the US. But well before that, countries were looking at what they needed to do to scale up their capability, their ability to make things, and also to think ahead about the use of technology in that, and have invested strongly. We have seen ourselves in many respects, I think, our big ambition is to be, the best customer on an app store. We're going to bring in someone else's idea and product and use it and totally neglect and avoid using concepts, ideas, research that was being translated into product right now to be used in the Australian environment. And I think we can do better than that.
Will it be focused on co-investment? I guess I'm wondering whether we'll end up with the situation, the old privatising profits and socialising losses, where assisting businesses that maybe couldn't make it on their own two feet. So what's the guarantee at the end of the process that the Australian government, shares in the benefit if there is a benefit?
Well, at the heart of the National Reconstruction Fund is the recognition of the need and the value of co-investment, of working with private sector on this. And it shouldn't be about replacement. It's about coalescing. It's about bringing together the power of both public and private investment, and also making it easy for private investment to get to the point where they can support things that they think will have long-term economic and commercial value, particularly when it comes to manufacturing. And so it is, I think, something that we want to be able to build on. It's certainly in the thinking of the Prime Minister.
And in terms of the National Reconstruction Fund, you mentioned it's a $15 billion fund. Give us an update on that. The Coalition has been running around saying no money's out the door yet. Mm-hmm. So can you give us an update about whether it's on schedule and when we're going to start to see that rolling out?
Well, as you know, we got the Act through Parliament last year. We put the board together with a chair. We just in January announced the new CEO, and he's filling out his Ivan Power, his senior leadership team, and also going through actively the deals that have been, or the ideas that have been put forward by businesses that want investment. Now, these aren't, and just bear in mind, I mean, a lot of the criticisms come out of the Coalition that would love a grant process. That's their big thing. And obviously, we saw in the last term of Parliament the way that they were very cavalier, very loose in the way that they used taxpayer dollars when it came to a grants program. What we want through the NRF are loans, guarantees, taking equity stakes, shares in some of these companies that are putting forward their ideas. And that does take a bit of work to make sure that, when we're going through and making the investments, the taxpayers, one, have confidence that the way that that's being done, and two, that it has some material, concrete, practical benefit in terms of building up manufacturing capability in the country. And so we're expecting, obviously, I've often remarked I'm probably the most impatient minister in government. I want these things to have happened yesterday, but we want the decisions to be right, not rushed. And we think that they are very much on the cusp of being able to make those investment decisions shortly. But again, we wanted a degree of separation. It's not me as a minister going through, thumbing through investment propositions on the desk of the CEO. We put people in with qualification, with capability to make those decisions that will be building up manufacturing capability across those priority areas of the fund. And I must say, it's a bit remarkable that you've got the coalition who have never really backed Australian manufacturing, who voted against the National Reconstruction Fund and now want to see its investments. I mean, the coalition has either through neglect or hostility avoided building up manufacturing capability until the last minute and now shouldn't be dictating to us, well, let's get moving on manufacturing, because we're effectively trying to clean up the mess that they've left us and the neglect that we've seen transform in an Australian industry sense.
How much of this is a rebadging or a repackaging of the National Reconstruction Fund, this Future Made in Australia agenda? I know this was a phrase used before the last election, but I guess I'm getting a sense, trying to get a sense of, is this the National Reconstruction Fund on, you know, supercharged, or is it something else in addition?
The National Reconstruction Fund reflects a determination by our government, by our Prime Minister in particular, to ensure that the things that we need will be here when we need them, particularly at times we need them most, or that we engage in a lot more value-adding activity, that we get the most out of our resources sector and agriculture using great minds and great businesses that can get value-adding done here on shore, which is good for the economy, secures it longer term and creates great jobs. So what the NRF is a example, is evidence of a philosophy, of a mindset that we're trying to bring here in the public space around the value of, you know, Australia being a country that makes things. This is not a binary choice. It's not saying that everything will now become manufacturing. A modern economy like ours is made up of different parts. There is a very strong, for example, services element to what we do. We clearly have a big dependency on resources and agriculture. But for us, the success longer term will be about deepening our economic complexity and thinking ahead about what's next and making sure that our economy moves with the times as well, and that we don't miss opportunity and that we also don't get overtaken. So a lot of that work is long term. It's not quick fix. It's not, you know, there are no sort of Red Bull equivalents of taking a shot of energy and thinking that it'll help us long term. This is the hard work that needs to start, and it needs to start now.
Now, you're the Minister for Industry. A big part of the history of industry policy in Australia has been the car industry leaving Australia. Mm. What lessons do you draw from that? Because at the end of that process, there were more requests for extra subsidies and support from government, which were rejected by the then coalition government. But what lessons as Minister do you draw from the car industry experience? And what role is there for automation and robotics in manufacturing in the future in Australia?
Well, I think what we learned out of that episode, and it was a dark episode for us, and I still remember seeing coalition ministers at the dispatch box in the Abbott government, coalition government, goading car manufacturers to leave, not realising that, you know, it's not just about the manufacturers, but everyone whose livelihoods, businesses, other businesses that were attached to them in terms of auto components and the like, and that we lost capability on design as well, because clearly you're thinking ahead about new products and new ways of doing things and improving your processes, and we just lost all that. And I think the big lesson out of that for me is that looking down, I think manufacturing has suffered, particularly in terms of the coalition, and I don't like making necessarily these political points, but I think it is important that a big part of their thinking and their mindset as a coalition is to look down at manufacturing and have an old world view about what manufacturing is, you know, about big metal gears and huge smokestacks and tailorist lines of workers. It's not that. It's about being able to make our own medicines. It's about being able to make the things that generate energy a lot cleaner and efficiently longer term. It's about the technologies that, be it in AI, quantum, robotics, that we can make here in Australia and deploy to give us the advanced manufacturing edge. Because, you know, we will, as we invest in human capital and the skills of our people, we need to pair it with obviously automation. And a lot of people think, well, automation will lead to job loss and be difficult for us. But we've just gone through, I reckon, one of the biggest decades when it comes to technology and being used more and more by industry. And we're also talking about that in a climate of skill shortages. So it's and near full employment. So it's about sharpening the way that we work, and also effectively too, using automation to avoid the dirty, dull and dangerous work that has not really meant that people have used their best skills or what they've been trained for. It's not been putting them to work at their best.
And I think automation... Do you have a message for unions in terms of accepting some level of automation then?
Well, I mean, we've been in the process and we'll be releasing shortly our robotics and automation strategy, where we did engage with unions and they were part of that process. And they also see in workplaces. I see blue-collar workers working with what are known as cobots, with them to work in their physical labour. You know, it gets them to do their job on a daily basis. A lot of people understand the role of technology. I think the thing that they're more concerned about is not technology of itself, but the way that business invests and uses it and applies it in the workplace and what impact it has on people, individual workers' jobs. That's the big thing. These are very human decisions about the way we use technology that need to be contemplated.
Another part of your portfolio, you've been looking at how to regulate artificial intelligence. Is it too late to put the genie back in?
What can
Australia do by itself?
I get asked this a bit about have governments, for example, not been quick enough? The answer is yes. Have governments thought enough about the regulation around the use of technology? No. Are governments taking this seriously? Yes. I mean, the reality is, if you look, for instance, I took part on behalf of the country in the discussions around the AI safety summit that was held in the UK in November. There was 30 countries there. I described at that point that was a pretty totemic, iconic moment, because governments hadn't really thought that they needed to work together on putting regulatory frameworks around the use of technology. There's a lot that AI can do, but there are high-risk areas where we've got to think through what impact that has on people. And so governments are in either individually or working with others thinking, okay, let's identify those high-risk areas and let's put some guardrails around them so that that way we can get the most of the technology while safeguarding people from the risk. And I think that's a big body of work that is being done.
At that summit in the UK, did you meet with Elon Musk?
I saw him in the distance.
Is he? Because he's spoken about AI as a potential threat to humanity, but he's also involved in development of AI systems. So is he a villain or is he a hero of this space?
When you were asking me that question, I instantly thought, there's been a lot. I always find in the technology space there are oodles of utopians and just as many dystopians. And it never seems to be either way. We don't get to either endpoint. I think there's something in the middle that happens. I do take the risks very seriously. I think they are risks, and we just can't let people develop technology with full-throated enthusiasm and not consider how that might play out in the real world. And I think that's the big thing more general. I think the general public gets it too. They understand how AI has helped. I mean, AI, as I've often said, we developed a vaccine in the middle of a pandemic when normally it takes over a decade to develop a medicine and put it out and a vaccine out in the field. And AI played a big role in that. Automation played a big role in that. But also the skill and talent and smarts of people were involved in that. And not just directly at the pointy end of the medical scientists and researchers, but governments too had to think through how to deal with this. So I think we can get these things done. We often talk down our ability to do so. But in terms of the villain and hero frame, if you don't mind, I might step away from that, though I appreciate it makes for good listening.
Now, to change pace and quite dramatically, actually, listeners will have heard you make several interventions over the past 6 months about events in Israel and Gaza. I want to take you back sort of at a big picture level. On the 16th of October, when you were addressing Parliament, you said, "Anyone with a surname like mine carries a legacy, genetic and historic. They come from a part of the world. It once had a name, Yugoslavia." And you went on to say, in a matter of years, that bond disappeared and the most depraved acts occurred between people who had said that they loved each other like brothers and sisters. I know the impact of hate and the way it tears apart societies. I've carried that since my 20s. Can you tell us a bit about that and how that shapes the way you've looked at events in Gaza and Israel over the past 6 months?
Yeah, well, even hearing those words now are pretty hard to to hear, in the sense of, because it evokes a lot of memory. And it was very difficult because I grew up at a time, particularly when people did call themselves Yugoslavs and recognise their background, and there was a very strong sense of kinship amongst groups of different religions, different ethnic backgrounds, and different parts of Yugoslavia as well. And then it all sort of broke apart. Now, it's always been something I've thought through, that the easier thing is to create a division and so hatred between people, the harder job and the more important one. And the better one longer term for countries is bringing people together. And I, at that point, was genuinely worried. And in that speech, I said I was worried about what would happen to Palestinians next. And I could see, because there was a lot of hurt and, dare I say, a lot of revenge driving decisions at that point post-October 7. And, you know, you can't necessarily have that drive the decisions, particularly when it comes to the application of force. And I think we've seen, as a result of that, what's happened, and that just a horrendous number of people that have been killed by decisions made by military in Gaza. We just can't have that, can't see that continue.
Why have you felt it important to speak up from time to time on this?
Because I feel like, I know and have for many years moved among people, particularly from an Islamic, an Arabic background, Palestinians who I've known who feel like their voice isn't heard. And I think democracies can be stronger by having different viewpoints in there. Sometimes the clash of viewpoints makes it difficult for you to see that it is a good thing. But it is important that people feel like that they're heard and that their viewpoints are being taken into account. And I think we need to be mindful of that. I am deeply concerned still about what's happening in Gaza, and not just now. I think I'm very concerned about the fact that people who have been making their way back to see their homes completely destroyed, to see everything that sustains community life gone, schools, hospitals, infrastructure, roads, how do you marketplaces, places where we take for granted. And I'm genuinely concerned too that we're at a point where people would be understandably thinking, are we seeing permanent displacement before our eyes? And that's a very serious issue under international humanitarian law. And I do think that, you know, the suggestion that has, you know, sort of gone around is that we would see, or that we would see potentially, that places in Gaza might become the next place for settlement activity, which would be a terrible outcome and an unacceptable one at that. And I think speaking up at different points, when you ask me the question about why, it's about, in many respects, one, letting people know that their concerns have somewhere to go to be vented and aired, and two, to flag things that we need to think about. And I think it is important that we do contemplate where events might head.
Does that mean that people have felt that their voices haven't been heard by the government?
I do think, it would be inconceivable for me to give you any other answer than yes, they have felt that. They felt that politics, modern Australian politics, if I can put it this way, hasn't heard those different viewpoints, and it is important to address that. And, obviously our government's moved quite a bit, but and sort of been involved in voting in December, for example, in ceasefire. But, you know, I think there'd be a lot of people that out there in the broad, I understand there are different views, and there'd be people that think, well, we could have moved quick enough and or quicker, and I understand why they might have those views.
Are you telling those communities that you're actively pushing for stronger positions within the government?
I think people, let me put it to you this way, people can see they can see and hear what I've said and the way that I've said it. And so I think they know where I stand on these issues. The other big issue I think that we need to do is continually, as much as I have very sharp criticisms about the way that the Israeli government has conducted itself in this, there is a big role for parliamentarians of all political colours to make sure that Jewish Australians, Islamic Australians, all Australians feel a degree of safety and surety and confidence in that, and that we are not, going back to your earlier question, that we are not dividing and creating a sense of deep division and tearing at social cohesion. And I think there's a lot more that can be done there as well.
On that front, I think Peter Dutton has mentioned you a couple of times. In December, after you described Israel's military action as very disproportionate, Dutton said that you, quote, flying off again this morning with comments that are offensive to the Jewish community here in Australia. And then a few months later, when you suggested that Australia should try to reinstate funding to the UN agency UNRWA as quickly as possible, given the warnings of famine, he said that, imagine if the proposition from Ed Husic was that our government should provide aid to Al-Qaeda or to a listed terrorist organisation otherwise. Are those sorts of comments hurtful to you?
I think it reflects more on Peter Dutton that he could say that. And the reality is Peter Dutton has not taken, even as a government minister, extremism seriously. You know, I have spoken up strongly, not just on Islamophobia, but anti-Semitism as well. I was deeply concerned post-Christchurch about the rise of far-right extremism. I've spoken up on that. People can go Google what I've said and what I've urged. I don't think Peter Dutton took the rise of far-right extremism or the coalition, that they did not take that seriously. And in fact, their biggest contribution in the debate through their various senators was to object to the term far-right extremism and effectively browbeat our security agencies to use different terms. That was their big thing. Peter Dutton has only found anti-Semitism as an issue now, but his track record suggests he didn't really think about it much when he was a minister and he could do something about it. The level of support for de-radicalisation and the seriousness in which we engaged to deal with that under his watch, not taken seriously. He can be as personal and obtuse as he wants in terms of what he does, but that's a reflection on him. And anyone who took the time to listen to his words of likening protests to Port Arthur, again, that speaks about the mindset of a very nasty person who's not about social cohesion and wants to paint people in the worst possible ways when his track record to deal with it at particular points of time is found wanting. And that's all I need to say on that.
You said recently that you believe there was a systematic failure within the Israeli government to genuinely commit to the observance of international humanitarian law. What do you say to the Israeli government's argument that the high civilian death toll is Hamas's fault?
Well, I mean, is that believable? I'm sorry, I'm not asking. That's a rhetorical question, clearly, but I don't think anyone who's watching that would genuinely believe that. I think that got to be able to show how you're distinguishing between civilians and combatant. You cannot completely obliterate all elements of community life in Gaza in terms of people's homes, their schools, their hospitals. I remember seeing the footage just in the last week of World Health Organization officials going into hospitals and being stunned by what they had seen, the level of destruction of those hospitals, the fact that there were still bodies in those hospitals and what that meant for the community. I think at some point, you know, people will go back. There will be bodies that go back to see, as in government bodies or legal bodies, to see what's done and how the Israeli government conducted itself through this operation. But I think it's clear that we have not, and we saw with the devastating events of all those people, and particularly Zomi Frankum, who suffered, those humanitarian workers who suffered, and they joined 200 that have lost their lives there, journalists that have lost their lives covering the scenes in Gaza. There will be investigations into that. There's no doubt. I absolutely have no doubt that there will be investigations in that, and Australia should support transparency and accountability there. And I will just make this last observation. When the US government went to track down Osama bin Laden, tracked him down, they held him to account, 30,000 Pakistanis were not killed in that process. You know, people were held to account, and the way that governments conduct themselves does matter. It absolutely matters. There is a big difference between the way some countries go about this, and obviously the US had to learn a lot out of Iran and Afghanistan. And you heard the president, Joe Biden, say, "We have learned our lessons. Don't make our mistakes." you know, they are speaking from that lived experience, and I think that's worthy of listening to.
I want to close by asking you about cabinet solidarity. You're obviously a cabinet minister. I haven't heard you criticise the Australian government directly, but have you felt pressure? Have you had any consequences internally for speaking up?
What I respect about Anthony Albanese is that he runs a cabinet government where people can speak their minds. And they can also speak their minds to outside of cabinet, to him directly. And I'm very grateful because I think this makes good sense that governments have a vibrancy of views and that they synthesise and come up with a combined position on issues of the day and issues of long-term significance. And I think, you know, Anthony, the whole time I know, he's never been afraid of different views and he allows them to be aired.
You've spoken in this podcast about the responsibility and even burden you might feel to speak up and give voice to people who are concerned their voices aren't being heard. Have you considered at any time resigning as a minister?
I think the burden comes not from having a different view to others in government. The burden is the sheer devastating impact that this has had in Gaza, and also what I feel that Australians here who have friends, family or friends in that part of the world worried about what happens next. And having lived through that, seeing what happened in the Balkan Wars, and there are a lot of people from my background, regardless of being Bosnian Muslim or Serb or Croat, everyone lived through it all and knows how terrible that chapter has been and how it sets countries back. And I think there's a degree, particularly I see it in terms of intergenerational trauma that gets re-enlivened through these events. That's the burden, Dan, like seeing what people have gone through and wondering what they go through. And I have to be at that cabinet table to be able to contribute to those things, and I take that very seriously. And so from my point of view, it is being a presence is, I would like to be able to have that opportunity. It took me a while to get there, and I'd like to be able to take full advantage of that at the moments that matter.
Minister Eddie Huzik, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thanks, Dan.
This interview was recorded on Monday, before a stabbing incident at Christ the Good Shepherd Church in Wakeley in Western Sydney. Police have charged a 16-year-old boy with a terrorist act. After the incident, Ed Husic posted on Facebook, "I stand with my Assyrian friends who have the absolute right to practice their faith in peace and in safety." Husic went on to say, "We all stand as one against violence, hatred and extremism." You can read more about the aftermath from that violence in Wakeley on theguardian.com. This episode was produced by Miles Herbert. The executive producer is Molly Glassy. I'm Daniel Hurst. Thanks for listening.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.